dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who brings great intelligence to bear on various aspects of this war for the free world, which is, after all, as we address day after day on this program, a multi-dimensional as well as highly dynamic phase of this long-running war, is our first guest. He is Robert Spencer. I'm delighted to say he is a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy. He is also the director of a really invaluable resource online at jihadwatch.org. It is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center, where he is a Shulman Fellow. He is the author of, last count, 23 books, including The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam and the Truth About Muhammad. He also has several at the Center for Security Policy Press, including most recently Islamophobia and the Threat to Free Speech. He has a new one coming out about which we will be talking in due course. But it's always good to visit with Robert Spencer. Welcome back, sir. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. Always good to talk to you.
I want to start with Afghanistan, Robert. Both what's happening there, what's happening in the neighborhood, and what might be coming to a theater near us as a result of, well, tens of thousands at a minimum of unvetted Afghan individuals being deposited in this country in the aftermath of our defeat at Joe Biden's hands in the country. Start with what we can tell is taking place on the ground for the people of Afghanistan, for Americans who, well, as we're told by the Biden administration, want to be there or otherwise can't get out, and what that tells us about the nature of the regime, as well as what it's now doing in Tajikistan.
As expected, Frank, the Taliban is ruthlessly enforcing Sharia in Afghanistan, and that is done in every detail. In other words, every aspect of women's rights has been severely curtailed, and the world media fell for the promises that the Taliban issued, saying we're going to respect women's rights within the limits of Islamic law, without realizing that Islamic law doesn't really grant women any serious right. So they are at a complete disadvantage at this point, relegated to domestic servitude, essentially, and that's all that they have to look forward to in the future there, as long as the Taliban remains in power. Meanwhile, of course, they have billions and billions of dollars worth of American military equipment, and in line with their statements here again about exporting their jihad outside Afghanistan, they have now begun to equip the Jamaat Ansarullah, the Tajik jihad group that is trying to overthrow the government of Tajikistan now. And so this American equipment, I think we're going to see being used to foment a great deal of instability in the region in the near future.
Well, as you say, this isn't exactly a surprise, but is it fair to say that the inspiration that the success of the jihadis in Afghanistan have achieved over the United States is assuredly emboldening, at a minimum, if not actually empowering, the global Islamic movement much farther beyond Central Asia, Robert?
Yes, there's no doubt about it. Jihad group and their sympathizers have published multiple statements over the last few weeks saying that this has been a tremendous victory for Islam in Afghanistan, and it's a signal that Allah has decided to bless the jihad of the Muslims at this time. And consequently, we're going to see, and we're already seeing, a tremendous emboldening of the jihadis around the world because they think that this is an opportune moment for them to act. And so I think that it's not a coincidence that in Iran, the new president, Ibrahim Raisi, has appointed numerous hardliners, as he himself is a hardliner, to his government, because this is not a time, clearly, he believes, for conciliation, for negotiations, for talks with the United States. The United States he perceives as weak and considers it to be a time to take advantage of that weakness by advancing the jihadist goals of the Islamic Republic as far as possible.
There is another aspect to that that's worrying, Robert, and maybe you could comment on it quickly. We've been told by the people who are supposedly monitoring the state of the Iranian nuclear weapons program that it is very close to having sufficient highly enriched uranium to manufacture one or more nuclear weapons. There is a lot of uncertainty, I guess, still to be sure, but about 10 weeks ago, we were told they might be 10 weeks away. Is there any evidence that you're familiar with that that the Israelis now are regarding this as an imminent peril to them and prepared to act accordingly?
Yes, I think that it's highly noteworthy, although it was virtually completely ignored, that when the Prime Minister of Israel, Naftali Bennett, met recently with Joe Biden, he said that he had refused three requests that Biden had made of him. And the third was in regard to Iran, although Bennett said that he was not at liberty to disclose the details about it. I think that it's likely, given the geopolitical situation, the state of the government in Washington and the state of the world in general, that Biden asked him not to strike Iran, and he said he couldn't give any such assurances because clearly the Israelis see that they're not going to get help from the United States in any significant way against Iran at this time. Iran is moving rapidly toward developing a nuclear weapon, and so the Israelis may have to go on their own to counter this threat.
I think that's been clearly the case for some time, but I understood that Naftali Bennett had made some further statement when he was in Israel after his meeting with Joe Biden that the time was getting very close when something was going to have to be done about this, reports to that effect. And obviously we're distracted by developments elsewhere around the world, but this is one that is of enormous geostrategic consequence. Let me ask you about one other question with respect to Afghanistan and jihadism. Robert, when you were last with us, we talked a bit about the importing into this country of large numbers of unvetted individuals, at least some of whom are military age men. And I think it's only reasonable to expect that they have been imbued with the same Sharia supremacism as is widespread in their country, not just among the Taliban, obviously, but among the population at large. Can you characterize how you see the potential for some of those folks becoming active jihadists in our country as they emerge from the bases on which they're currently being held?
There is no doubt that among the Afghan refugees, there are jihadis. This is because of a variety of factors. One is that not long after the Americans irresponsibly abandoned Bagram Air Force Base in Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, the Taliban went in and released from prison thousands of ISIS and Al-Qaeda prisoners who had been held there. And this was right before the plane started taking off for America. If you can imagine the chaotic situation at the Kabul airport, who would be most likely to be able to muscle to the front of the line and get on those planes but the most ruthless and violent of the people who were trying to do so? I think it's virtually certain that at least some of those ISIS and Al-Qaeda prisoners were on those planes and are in the United States now. There have already been some arrests. There was in Britain one of the Afghan refugees who had been placed in a luxury hotel, was the subject of a raid by British authorities who had determined that he was actually apparently on a terror watch list. And there have been also incidents of that kind in the United States, as well as arrests of Afghans for acting as if they were still in Afghanistan, engaging in spousal abuse and child sexual abuse, which is two things that are generally accepted in Afghan culture, but of course not here. This kind of disruption and upheaval culturally, as well as the very live possibility that they're jihadis, we're going to be seeing a lot more of this in the United States in the near future.
Similar considerations have prompted the polls recently to, be communicating with Muslim immigrants, not necessarily from Afghanistan, but that may have some of these same characteristics, essentially telling them to go back from whence they came. This is of a piece with, I think, the general attitude of those in Central and Eastern Europe, not so much those in authority in Western Europe, Robert, about the existential nature of the threat such immigrants pose to their countries, to their cultures, to their societies, to their people. Tell us what we should know about what the polls are doing and whether this is a very sensible approach to a very real problem.
Yeah, it's extraordinarily interesting in light of a lot of the controversies in the United States, because the polls have built a fence. They are guarding their border and telling, as you noted, the migrants who are overwhelmingly Muslim that they need to go back. The polls have made no apologies about wanting to preserve their own society and culture, and noting that the migrants are bringing a radically different society and culture based on Sharia. Consequently, they simply don't want them there. Most of them are coming from Iraq, with some from Afghanistan and Syria, and Polish officials, as well as some others in that area of Europe, in Hungary and elsewhere, have been quite clear, saying that these people would be much more at home linguistically, culturally, religiously in majority Muslim countries, which of course have no refugee problem, no illegal entry problem. And yet they're the natural destination, really, for these migrants. Obviously, there's a very different agenda involved. Many of them are economic migrants. Many of them are wanting to extend the Hijra, the emigration for the cause of Allah, to take Islam into Europe. And the Poles are one of the few who are standing against this.
In fact, this has been something that has prompted, particularly with the Hungarians, but I assume with the Poles as well, virulent criticism from Brussels over the lack of hospitality to this Muslim, principally Muslim immigrant influx. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. The European Union is furious and has repeatedly rebuked the Central European states for supposedly not carrying their weight regarding the migrant influx. Apparently, the European Union has decided that it is an obligation of all the European Union states to take a certain number of so-called refugees without any regard for the cultural and societal upheaval that we have already seen happening in Germany, France, Britain, Italy, and elsewhere. And so these Central European states, Poland, Hungary, and to a lesser degree, Austria and some of the others, they are quite right to stand firm against this pressure. And we can only hope that they continue, because the consequences of this mass unvetted Muslim migration are already quite obvious in Germany and elsewhere, in spikes in criminal activity, spikes in jihad activity, and more.
Let me lastly ask you about a topic that we touched on last time you were with me, Robert, and that is the incompatibility between Sharia, this Islamic supremacist doctrine on the one hand, and religious tolerance. We discussed it then in the context of the appointment by the Biden administration of Rashad Hussein to be the next U.S. ambassador at large for international religious freedom. You expressed some serious reservations about his ability to perform the function of promoting religious tolerance in light of the intolerance inherent in his faith doctrine. This would seem to be the same problem, something that would preclude a recent joint declaration by the Muslim World League, a prominent Muslim Brotherhood umbrella organization, and the World Jewish Congress. And yet they have jointly expressed their strong commitment to religious freedom. What's going on here, Robert? And where does the truth lie?
Well, you know, the Muslim World League over the years, Frank, has repeatedly expressed sentiments that would surprise, I believe, the its friends in the World Jewish Congress. And it has ties to various groups that have been considered jihad-linked in the past. And consequently, I'm not sure this is very wise of the World Jewish Congress to enter into this joint statement. I don't think that they can reasonably expect that the Muslim World League has set aside the imperatives to anti-Semitism in the Quran and the Hadith, the imperatives to jihad violence against Jews and others in the Quran and Hadith, and that consequently this is an exercise in trying to foster complacency regarding the jihad threat among non-Muslims in the West. And unfortunately, the World Jewish Congress is not sufficiently informed, I would imagine, about the nature of Islamic doctrine and the teachings of the core documents of Sharia regarding the Jews and regarding jihad to be aware of how they are being manipulated in this case.
For the moment, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for your time today and for the extraordinary job you do tutoring the rest of us. We appreciate it very much, and we look forward to talking with you again soon. Next up, we'll speak
Thank
with
you very much.
Robert Charles, former Assistant Secretary of State, about China and more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back and joined by former Assistant Secretary of State Robert Charles, a man we have the privilege of consulting with from time to time, drawing on his experience as a former naval intelligence officer, as a counsel in the White Houses of Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush, as well as his stint as the Assistant Secretary for Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs in the State Department of George W. Bush. He is an extraordinarily prolific commentator, notably for the Association of Mature American Citizens, a terrific organization for whom he is a spokesman. He is also the author of Eagles and Evergreens, a great read, and we're always delighted to have a chance to visit with him. Bobby, welcome back, sir.
Thank you very much, Frank.
I'd like to start with your perspective, particularly given your time in senior U.S. government positions, notably the White House, concerning what is being done increasingly, it seems, by the Biden team in various ways, but perhaps most dramatically and most recently by Merrick Garland, the Attorney General of the United States, to deem individuals, parents in this case, who are decrying the so-called critical race theory training in American public schools as potential domestic terrorists. What do you make of this, Bobby, in terms of, well, the law, for one thing, but also for its implications for freedom of speech and for our country more generally as a constitutional republic?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, Frank, I read that story. I've read it in several locations. I've read his direct quotes, and I find it more than untoward. It really is, it strikes me as really anti-constitutional. I mean, on many levels. So we start out with the fact that school boards are local, and so that the federal government really has no role, should have no role in managing a school board. Then you move to the idea that you're literally using the power and the force and the coercion of the federal government to chill people's speech. You're trying to intimidate them into not speaking, which is really, again, antithetical constitutionally to our First Amendment and the intent and the legislative intent and all of the thinking that has ever gone in to the way that the First Amendment works. Then you've sort of created a false story all over again by taking apparently a couple of instances where parents got sufficiently upset that they said something and created out of that a national crisis that relates to deploying federal resources against against parents for purposes of defending their children's education. Then you go to the level of really an intrusion into the family and the idea that the family has the right to decide religious issues, decide issues tied to education. I mean, I wonder what this means for their potential looming attack on homeschooling. I mean, to me, I don't understand, unless you are intentionally abusing the powers of the federal government to suppress speech or to intimidate speech, which it looks like they may be trying to do, that makes no sense at all, particularly against the backdrop of 2020, in which you saw just a stand down across the United States when 200 cities essentially blew up and were burned, and businesses, including particularly minority businesses, were so badly affected. So, but this is an attack on the First Amendment, on free speech, on the family, on the local control over education. And I don't understand it. I mean, Frank, to the extent that I understand it as an intentional offense, which I think cannot stand. And I have to believe that when challenged, and perhaps it will be challenged in ways that require some sort of immediate ruling, I have to believe that any court looking at the United States Constitution would not permit this kind of overreach.
I hope you're right that this will be challenged in court and it will be, you know, struck down post haste. But it is chilling, no doubt about it. Go ahead.
I'll add one last, you know, point, and that is that, you know, whether you are reading Plato's Republic or whether you're reading the Communist Manifesto, the idea that you centralize all power and essentially an elite uses power to suppress the larger individual, the capacity for individual will, that to me looks like really the unifying in all the wrecking operations you're talking about. What you're really doing is taking power away from individuals, families, cities, towns, and states in order to centralize it in a federal government. And that is scary.
Yeah, well, it's a Marxist revolution, I think, is what the ultimate objective is. But in the meantime, it's in the destruction phase for sure. Bobby, let me just turn to China, which is, of course, the existential threat to freedom external to our borders, though its involvement inside our country, its influence operations is, of course, very much a problem here too. But talk us through, you've done a piece at amac.us in which you describe China as stumbling. And I want to tease out what you mean by that and then examine what the implications of that might be if it's true.
Yeah, I think that so it's completely fitting, of course, that when we talk about centralization of power, both politically and economically, that we turn our attention and militarily to that's to be expected, to China. And you know what's happening here, and you can read it anywhere you want to look. You can read it at, you know, The Economist or The Wall Street Journal, The Business Insider. What you're seeing is that several things are overlapping one another, if you will, cresting waves, and they do have implications for security. One of the waves is that since 2008, China has taken on almost twice the debt that they previously had. The second is that their energy sector is beginning to stumble with, I think there are 19 provinces now that are getting intermittent or power cuts and breaks. And there's a broader concern that their industries, particularly related to energy, which is, of course, central to every other sector, are in many ways falling to the natural, just as the Soviet Union did, to the natural outcome of a command and control economy. In other words, in a market economy, you have billions of decisions made by millions of people that immediately create a supply and demand ebb and flow. In a command and control economy, which is dominated from the center, you don't get that flexibility or nimbleness. So we can be in terrible debt, and we are. And we have the power as people to get our members of Congress to stop spending, to lower the debt ceiling, to address the debt, to cut programs, et cetera. But that's not what happens in a communist-controlled country. And so as a result, they're both rigid and they're also stumbling economically. My biggest concern is that as they slow down, and you even have articles written in places like Foreign Affairs saying this is the end of China's rise, as they slow, and it could, and it's happening pretty quickly, what you're going to see is it's like a cornered animal, a desperate animal in the form of President Xi, potentially turning on Taiwan, potentially turning on internally, but also turning externally and utilizing this moment of Biden weakness and perceived American indifference or weakness, or I could use even more colorful words, to take advantage of this moment and to do some real harm to Western values and to countries like Taiwan.
Well, let me just say, I hope it's the case that we can exercise pressure on our elected representatives to cut spending and reduce the deficit and debt and so on. I'm not sure in practice that's what's going to happen here either. But you're certainly right that there's no break on it in China, and we're watching this meltdown of their real estate, market, for example, and the financial sector is being put into tremendous turmoil by decisions being made by the center, by the party, by Xi Jinping, it seems himself. And it does raise this question of what I guess has been called historically social engineering by a totalitarian to get them out of a sticky wicket, as the Brits say, a difficult place by conjuring up or creating out of whole cloth a foreign adversary or a foreign threat, and justifying oppression of their own people as what must be done for the national good in the face of this dire circumstance. And Bobby, I guess I would say, when you look at what Xi is now incessantly propagandizing his people with, which is essentially hectoring to prepare for war, that may well be what's underway, and Taiwan may be the immediate focus of it, but I'm not sure that's the full extent of it. What are your thoughts on the current threats to Taiwan, and whether that may be just part of a larger campaign?
Well, the natural course of events is to look at things in a binary way and to imagine that we can look at it and find a linear connection. I think it may be difficult to disentangle the internal propaganda piece of this and the genuine threat to the external world, including and perhaps even starting with Taiwan or some of the other islands that are nearby that are under contest, or potentially more aggressive actions in Hong Kong. But the difficulty is, having spent time in an earlier day in the Soviet Union, when it was the Soviet Union, in Soviet-dominated Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Yugoslavia, East Germany, what you find, this is a very tying together piece of this conversation, because not only do you find suppression of liberties as they're associated domestically with things like education and being free from police overreach, but they propagate, and I have a lot of their old propaganda, they propagate the idea that they were at war with someone, they were at war with us. We always referred to it as the Cold War, but they put themselves in a position of imminent, believing that they were under imminent threat, which was one of the justifications they used for suppression of all human rights internally. Well, China has long suppressed human rights internally, and they are ramping up their propaganda internally, the idea that that they've got some sort of a global destiny for domination, and that we're in their way. So yes to both, but I think that it's difficult because you have to try to disentangle the propaganda they're using internally to control their own people, and in this instance, to perhaps even begin explaining away disintegration in the financial, real estate, energy sectors, and debt. And at the same time, you have to be aware that they have the capacity to do real damage in the world. And so they seem to blunder sometimes into very hostile actions. And I would hate to see that happen.
Well, this is of particular concern at the moment, where it may be that the kind of aggressive behavior they're engaged in will translate into an accident rather than conflict by design. But either way, it could very easily ratchet to extremely violent and dangerous proportions. One other piece of this, Bobby, drawing on your experience with these various totalitarian operations during the Cold War and now looking at China, that I find very worrying in terms of specifically the possibility that, as we were talking about a moment ago, some of this is leaching into our own society. And I'm thinking in particular of the so-called social credit system of China and the aggregation of extraordinary amounts of personal data and other information that is widely available to, for example, the social media tech giants in this country. Once there is a so-called vaccine passport platform that could be used to take your personal health information and combine it with that other data about where you work, where you live, you know, what you buy, what you eat, who you speak to, what you say when you speak to them, and all the rest, you could get very quickly in the hands of a government that wished to exploit this for purposes that are not only enforcing vaccine mandates, perhaps, but in other ways, controlling the population. Again, something that might well be what Marxist revolutionaries or wrecking operations have in mind, imposed in our own country as well. Should we be concerned about that?
Absolutely, we should be concerned about that, Frank. Aggregation of power begins with aggregation of information. And when you can get private information and use it for intimidation and use it for control of someone's health and welfare, never mind their personal security or their job security. All of that is why Americans have always, I mean, go back to the beginning and come right up to the near present. We have always been very cynical or critical or suspicious of any aggregation of information that's private by the government. So, you know, you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to understand that. Go back to, you know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, or Edmund Burke, who separately said, all it takes for evil to prevail is for good people to do nothing. You must protect your own information and your own family's information and your own security. And that's why America works, by the way, because we believe in the idea that everyone has control over their own rights and their own family information, their own everything about your life is a decision set that is made by you and with very limited government guardrails. That's why we call it limited government in order to protect ordered liberty. But we don't get into the business of centralizing power in order to control people. And so I am concerned about it. And I think that you know, as you mentioned a moment ago about China, sometimes you can back into a hot fire. You can accidentally stumble into a situation where you wake up and say, hey, wait a minute, I didn't think you were going to use that information for that purpose, or I didn't think I was going to lose that opportunity. So yeah, I am suspicious, and I'm naturally of the view that government should be limited, and I think we should all be of that view, and I think we should go back and look a little bit at history, just even the last 100 years' history, and understand that there has been an accelerating trend line to the aggregation of power at the federal level, and we need to resist that in the same way that people like Ronald Reagan and Russell Kirk and you know, Bill Buckley and all kinds of other people made clear that aggregation of power is dangerous, and we don't want that.
Well, the thing has been made more complicated because essentially all of that information that you were just describing, we are reluctant to have in the hands of an overreaching government, is in the hands of people who are perfectly prepared to work with that overreaching government, it seems, in the social media space. And so we may be farther down this road than most of us appreciate, and it makes your admonitions all the more important. Bobby, let me very quickly just ask you, because I know you've spent a lot of time on it, both in government and out. The current state of our border has become even worse than it was the last time we visited with you, which was a short while ago. There's now talk about having an influx of 400,000 people headed our way at this moment, and essentially nothing to prevent them from gaining entrance to our country. Just a quick word on where we are in this regard and what we best be doing about it right quick.
Yeah, the nutshell version is that we're at an unprecedented place in terms of abdication of the proper authority of a federal government, which is to protect those inside against events and threats from outside, and in particular to protect the sovereignty of the country. What I think is going to happen is that lawsuits that were once thought dead are going to come back. There's going to be, a run to the Supreme Court to try to establish a greater degree of order down there. And I guess my greatest fear is that if this administration doesn't wake up and smell the coffee and understand that you have a genuine obligation to protect Americans at the Southwest border, then you're going to see state governors with all kinds of resources and perhaps even citizen groups begin to start to do that. And that amounts to a writ large version of vigilante justice. And that's not a good thing because it leads to a sort of escalating violence. And my argument is, again, it's Edmund Burke all over again. It's if you don't, good people, including those in government, need to say, hey, this is enough. This is enough. We have to protect that border. You've got 85,000 Haitians, and you've got basically both public health and public safety issues at work there. And abdication of responsibility is, to me, this is at a level we've never seen before.
Correct. Robert Charles, on that, we have to leave it. Thank you for your service to our country, my friend, in uniform. And the civilian side of the House, as well as that you're rendering at the Association for Mature American Citizens these days. We look forward to our next visit. Thanks for joining us today. Next up, I believe we'll be speaking with Lieutenant General William Jerry Boykin about the state of our military and the dangers we're facing externally and internally. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it is one of the greatest privileges of my life to be able to say that we are joined by one of our most distinguished military veterans, a special operator of extraordinary accomplishment and renown. His name is Lieutenant General William Jerry Boykin. These days, he is the executive vice president of a terrific organization, the Family Research Council. But prior to joining the council, he served in the uniform of the United States Army in most of the most elite and decorated outfits in our armed forces, often commanding them. He was, among other things, on many occasions, deeply involved in intelligence operations and responsibilities. He finished up his tour in uniform as the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. He is a personal and cherished friend of mine, and we are always delighted to have him as a guest. General Boykin, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Well, thank you, Frank. I'm always happy to be with you.
Let me ask you first, if I may, about something that we were talking about with our previous guest, Bobby Charles, and that is the implications, as you see them, from the vantage point of someone who has served, as I say, both in the military and other aspects of our security agencies, of having the Attorney General of the United States declare large numbers of parents across this country are potential domestic terrorists.
Look, I think our founders would roll over in the grave if they could see this kind of thing happen. This administration is doing everything they can to deny us the very freedoms that our Constitution protects. You know, the Constitution doesn't give us freedom, it protects our freedoms. And these people are taking those things away incrementally, one at a time. And I think they've miscalculated on this because they went after moms. They went after moms who are not going to stand by and let their kids be taught from a pornographic book in the first through fifth grade. And that kind of thing, I think, is an overreach by this administration, by the Attorney General himself. And I think this is going to hurt them.
This brings me to the reason that many of those mama bears and other parents are in the school boards, and that is this so-called critical race theory agenda and the indoctrination of our kids that is being done in the name of countering racism, systemic racism, you know, the white supremacism and all this nonsense. You have had experience with what this is doing to our uniformed military, which is also being subjected to this kind of indoctrination. Talk about the genesis of this agenda. I call it communist racist training. What is it about, and what is it doing to not just our kids, but to our service personnel and other government employees and folks being imbued with this agenda?
Yeah, well, critical race theory is not something new. It's it has come into its own, but it's been in the universities for several decades. But what is happening now is the Marxist movement in America, and you can say communist movement if you prefer, because it's really all the same. The Marxist movement in America today is going back to the fundamentals of Marxism, and that means they have to divide the country. They have to divide us as a people, as a society. Karl Marx talked about division and class warfare. He broke things down along the lines of the proletariat versus the bourgeois or the bourgeoisie. And now what we have done is we've broken our society down again in terms of race. And even now, even gender, because of the fluidity of the whole gender picture. And that is creating the division that is needed. But then, okay, so why the military? Well, you can't change our society unless you change the military. You got to get the military woke. You got to get the military speaking the language. People have to see that the military is out front on this. And that helps them to implement their agenda in the larger society. But think about this. The thing that we need most on the battlefield, and I'm an old Special Forces soldier, and I understand ground combat. And I will tell you that give me all the weapons that I need, give me the technology I need, but if what I need more than anything else is I need a reliable group of men, soldiers, that trust each other, that are willing to risk their lives for each other. And don't think that I'm just saying that, because I've written men up for the Medals of Honor, and it was approved for saving their buddies at the cost of their own lives. So I know what I'm talking about. And when you sit them down and you tell half of them that they are the oppressors and the other half, they are the ones that have been oppressed, you're not building that cohesion. You're not building cohesion. You're building division. And that is the last thing you need in a military unit. But this whole thing about dividing our military and making it a woke military, how'd that work out for you in Afghanistan? How'd that work out there, Mr. Secretary of Defense, Mr. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs? How'd that work out? Did you reach your goal of getting a woke military there, or pretty close to it? Yeah, but how about how did you perform? How did you plan? How did you strategize? That's the real question. And the answer is, in a very poor fashion that cost people's lives.
General, one other tie-in to the police point that you just made is, it seems as though part of this agenda is actually driving people out of uniform, whether it's that of the police or whether it's that of our military, and replacing them with people who are going to be more aligned with this agenda. Again, what are the implications of that? Are we at the real risk of having the very people we need to protect our country, and we're going to talk in a moment about just how much we do need them at this very moment to be there to protect us. Are we purging them out of uniform?
You know what? If you go back and look at Joseph Stalin's history, when he took over from Lenin, he purged 36,000 senior officers out of his military. And now, that was a devastating blow, too, when the Germans attacked, because all those senior officers had been purged. But that's exactly what's happening to the military. We're purging our military now. We're purging them in a couple of ways. It goes all the way back to Barack Obama. And I've been saying this for quite some time. Obama bypassed a lot of good officers. a lot of good people that had combat records, that were known leaders, and brought in people at the senior levels that would support his agenda. And you're seeing some of those people right now in key positions. I mean, don't think for a minute that Milley wasn't one of those. Lloyd Austin was one of those. And now they're in charge. So what we're seeing happen is we're seeing these same people that started their career towards the stars, if I may use that term, under Barack Obama. You're seeing them now reaching the pinnacle of leadership within our DOD, and you've got people bailing out of the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and I think record numbers, largely because they don't like what they see. They don't like this critical race theory. They don't like being expected to go off to war and not having the advantage of being properly prepared and trained. That's an issue with them. They didn't come in the Army to sit through classrooms and have somebody telling you that you're a racist and then dividing your organization so that you know, those soldiers know that when they go on the battlefield, they've got to depend on each other, and that's being destroyed. They also know that wasting their time in a classroom is time that they could be using out there doing something that is meaningful in terms of preparing for war. They could be out on the range somewhere. They could be out doing all kinds of things other than sitting in a classroom listening to somebody tell them that they're either a racist or they are victims of racism. So they're leaving the military, but then you throw in this mandated vaccination, and I'm telling you that could be the undoing of our military. And now I get people call me every day about they're leaving the military. They're going to go. Is there any way we can help them? Is there anything we can do?
And special forces guys, especially,
kind of
I imagine, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
The best trained, the most elite, the most necessary. What's this doing to the confidence of the troops, the rank and file men and women in uniform, with respect to another vital element of how they are going to perform in combat? And that is, will they have confidence in those general officers based on what they're telling them to do now?
No, just look at what has happened with these two lieutenant colonels that have tried to speak out. You know, now they did so knowing that they were going to get in trouble. Yeah, Lohmeyer and Scheller. Yeah, well, people are watching that. Don't think for a minute that people aren't watching that, and they're watching that these guys are swiftly either jailed, put in the brig, as in the case of Scheller, or in the case of Lohmeyer, expedited out of the United States Air Force. But what's happening to people like Mark Milley, who, in my view, clearly usurped the president's power, provided aid and comfort to the enemy, and then assumed part of the president's power, that apparently that portion which deals with the nuclear launch procedures. So they watch this, and the morale in our military right now, I think, is certainly lower than I've ever seen it. And again, a lot of people are getting out. And now what are you going to wind up? Well, you're going to wind up with a military that has reduced the standards for being able to come in. And you're going to wind up with people with felonies and people that have heavy drug use, people that are not high school graduates, people that are not fit, people that don't have the mental agility or capacity to be in the military, to figure out how to use the complex technology that is used in our military today. And then what we're going to have is we're going to have a substandard military. We're on the way very quickly to a substandard military that will not be able to do what needs to be done. Look at China. Look at the developments in China. Look at Russia. Look at Iran. And we're not even going to be able to compete with them.
Well, the issue really is, isn't it, that we may not be able to deter them, which is the first order of business. You'd really rather not fight them, but just trying to prevent them from thinking they can act aggressively against us or our interests is vital. General, let me just conclude with one final question. You have been among those in a group called Flag Officers for America. One of the things that got a lot of attention with respect to one of the letters that you wrote back in May was a comment that seems absolutely, you know, indisputable, namely that, you know, a critical factor in our national security is the fitness of the commander in chief. And that needs to be addressed as well, in particular in light of this recent comment by John Kerry that he didn't know anything about. It was utterly unaware, I think was the way Kerry put it, of this major strategic play. We're told by the administration this was a huge deal, the Brits and the Americans combining to help provide nuclear-powered attack submarines for our allies down in Australia. But two things seem to be operating. Either he doesn't have the mental capacity to remember that he was involved in that decision-making process, or he wasn't in the loop, Joe Biden. Either one of which is very alarming, it would seem to me, especially, as you say, at a time when we are facing very serious challenges, particularly from the Chinese. So to your credit, you talked about this in your letter. Just, if you would, elaborate on how important that calculation is in both deterrence and our ability to contend with the dangers that we're now facing.
Yeah, well, there's more to the story. I mean, let's just look at the fact that four different generals in testimony last week said that they told the president that they recommended keeping 2,500 people in Afghanistan. And he, the president, said that nobody ever told him that. Okay, well, it's the same thing you were just talking about. Either he is lying to the public, or he really doesn't remember. Either way, we've got a huge problem. I'd almost rather see him lying than to know that he cannot remember what those four people told him. And I don't know which one it is, but it is certainly significant.
Either one is pretty bad.
But yeah, it's significant enough. There has to be some serious consideration for his mental agility and his mental faculties. Look, for 4 years, they chased Donald Trump over his mental state. The left went after Trump every day over his mental state. And you remember Maxine Waters, impeach 45, you know, he was not stable. He shouldn't be there. Okay, well, all right. Yeah, okay. Then let's compare why you were saying that about him with why I say this about Joe Biden. And I'm not the only one by any means, but I think that all you have to do is watch a speech. Just watch his speech. Watch some of the things that he does. Watch some of the times when he just appears to be totally lost and not even sure where
sometimes
he is.
Sometimes literally, at the White House, no less.
No, literally. Literally, yes. Look, it's a simple question. The purpose of this call today is not to just bash the president, but this is a serious situation.
God bless you, General Jerry Boykin. Thank you for your time today, sir, and all of your service to our country, including that you're rendering these days at the Family Research Council. Come back to us again soon, if you would, sir. Hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.